Thanks for tuning in. This is the Mile High Show, episode number 16 and week two of me with virtually no voice. So I want to thank Brian Kahatsu for bearing with me this week as we sat down at Anzio's restaurant in Phoenix to record this episode. We'll just get right into it. I'll have links to his website and his calendar where you can catch him doing some fine stand-up throughout the Phoenix area, Phoenix and Scottsdale. Hope you enjoy this episode. And again, apologize for the distraction of my voice or lack thereof. So hope you enjoy it.
Actually, we're just getting ready to record right now. Oh, probably not.
What?
So, okay. All right, I'll call you when I'm on the road. Yeah. Okay. Okay, bye.
You want to get that in there so I can just get a read?
Do I need to be right on it? Do I need to eat it?
Right there is good, yeah. And I'm going to unplug that, okay. Make sure I'm still recording. And I'm going to apologize again. I'm so scratchy. It's been like this for about 2-3 weeks. Brian and I have been sitting here for an hour or so, maybe a little more, eating lunch and chatting, and we forgot to turn the recorder on, I guess. So we're done. That was a great show.
You missed
Thanks.
2 hours of great conversation. It was riveting. Some of the funniest stuff you guys have ever heard. So
yeah, no, I was involved, so it's not that funny. Where we're sitting at is Anzio's Italian Restaurant, 12418 North 28th Drive, Suite 1 in Phoenix. I'll stick a link on there, anzios.com. It's a great lunch.
Yeah.
It's a great spot to come to. I'm sitting here with Brian Kahatsu.
Well, hello.
Hiya.
Hi, 2 hours later. Nice to see you.
Before we even get in, let's get the business part out of the way. Where can folks reach out to you? Where can they find your info?
BrianKahatsu.com. It's BrianKahatsu.com. It's Brian with an I, the way God intended it to be. Yeah, they can find me there.
Good. You get to do most of the talking today because, like I said, my voice is trashed. It's been like this for a while. So if you start hearing some mush mouth, that's me sucking on lozenges.
You hear a respirator in the back, yeah. Matt's getting through it.
The bad part of these Ricolas is they only work if you're wearing lederhosen. With a
good
big
thing you're wearing them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Commando style. Tell us where we're at. This is a place that's you're no stranger to.
This restaurant, Anzio's, was established in 1986 when I graduated high school, and I've been coming here since they've expanded the restaurant. It used to be half the size it is now, but yeah, we used to come here for wings all the time, eat them like crazy. Yes, we have a family history of just coming here repeatedly every Friday night. I like to say that this restaurant's responsible for me being fat now. So if you're going to get fat, do it the best you can.
That's why you were so anxious to do a podcast with me. Makes you feel better about yourself.
And then I thought, let's just grow together. So
now, I don't know if you noticed, we started recording just before we actually introduced you. We started recording right about the time your phone rang.
Oh.
So we didn't get a clearance from your wife. But that was your wife that was on the other end of that phone call.
Yeah, I've got an errand to do when I'm done here.
Now, how long have you been married?
23. Coming up on 24 years.
But you knew her long before that. High school sweethearts?
High school sweethearts. Met in third grade. So we were, what, 7 when we met? Yeah, didn't start dating until the end of our junior year in high school. So, yeah, we had a very long life together.
Now, you get long life. We're in Phoenix. You got a long life down here in the valley.
Yeah, native of Glendale. Actually born in Glendale. Lived here my entire life. And you know, my family's from here. My family still lives here. So we're local. We're loyal people.
Your family comes through in your act. You talk a lot about
your
heritage. What was it like growing up in the, you know, as a kid, late 70s? In the valley, we've seen a lot of changes.
Oh yeah. So my father was a farmer, farmed a lot of land around Glendale. So yeah, I mean the properties that my dad used to farm on are like all condos and strip malls now. And so, I mean, the Valley, you know, the Valley in general has changed a lot. Glendale's grown a whole lot during that time period. So, yeah, I mean, growing up, it was just a lot of dirt. We had dust storms and you couldn't see outside your door kind of thing.
Where'd you guys live?
We were on, you want the exact address?
No, I mean, you like on the outskirts?
Stop by and see. No. so there's a big tour that goes on in my parents' house.
it's like the Anne Frank house.
Exactly. There's little scriptures. I lived in the attic for a few years. It's very hot in the summer. I lost a lot of weight then. No, we were like pretty centralized Glendale, like right around 45th Avenue and Northern area.
I've got some friends that their parents and generations have lived in this area, and where they were on the outskirts of town, where, you know, they would ride horses, is now smack dab in the
right.
middle. As far as the look of the land, what a lot of farm, were you on the outskirts of farmland? Did you live in the suburbs? What
was it was kind of that weird thing where there used to be like all these subdivisions, and then there'd be farms. Sometimes in the middle of the subdivision, like where I ended up going to grade school, there was an empty lot for a long time that actually my dad actually grew carrots out of there. So it was like schools and homes and farms. So the area we were in, there wasn't too many horse owners in that area. That was further north from us.
More ag.
Yeah.
He's got, like, what'd your dad, did he supply to local markets and stuff? Did he work for a company or was it a family
farm? No, it was a family-owned Kohatsu Farms, and it was just basically my dad. My dad, you know, had people that worked for him, and which would be my brother and I and sister in the summers. But, yeah, it was dry produce, so green onions and that. Local markets, plus, like, Safeway was one of his big clients, too. So, you know, and the occasional guy who would come into the field and start stealing vegetables my dad would catch. So first one's free, after that get out. So no one ever got shot is what I'm saying. So my dad was a peaceful man.
Not that you talk about. What was how many generations was the family here?
My dad was born here. So my grandparents came from Japan in, I think it was 1919. They came over from Okinawa. They settled actually in San Francisco area. And then shortly after an earthquake there, they decided, let's leave. So they actually, they came to Scottsdale originally and then moved out to Glendale to start farming there. So my grandfather was a farmer too. And according to my father, a very bad farmer. So my dad said, we used to go hungry all the time, even with the food that he grew. So
traditional Japanese household on your dad's side?
Yeah. I mean, with the exception of moving to the States, right? Yeah. But yeah, and Americanizing pretty quick. So, but yeah, my brother, or my father was the only male, and then I have six aunts. So my dad pretty much ended up raising the aunts, but taking care of them.
He was the oldest?
He was right smack in the middle.
Oh.
And then when his father died, it was kind of like he ended up becoming the one who took care of everybody in the family, so...
What was mom's side of the family like?
My mother was an only child, and she's from upstate New York, Syracuse, Ithaca. Ithaca's actually where she's from. We heard the stories of walking in the snow, you know, 10 miles in the snow. When we finally saw where my mom lived, she lived right across the street from the school.
Well, inflation.
Yeah, so we're like, whatever, mom. So
uphill both ways.
Exactly. So it's funny, the difference between my mother and my father is, you know, my father's that traditional Japanese side. My mother's side of the family, as my father used to describe it, was the y'all come kind of folk. And yeah, it's different lifestyle when we'd go see my mom's side of the family. So
Caucasian on your mom's side?
Caucasian 100% on the other side, that's for sure. Hatfields and McCoys kind of thing.
Yeah.
So like my mom's maiden name was like Courtright. So that's as close to Cartwright and Bonanza as you can get, you know.
Well, what about siblings? Who'd you have? Brothers?
I have my sister is the oldest, and then I have a brother, and then myself, the youngest. So, and they still live in the valley, too. So,
families, you got nieces, nephews?
Yeah, my sister's got a brood of three, and then my brother's got two, and I've got two myself. So, yeah, families... I think we're done growing for now.
Yeah.
So there's grandkids coming, I think, on my brother's side. sister's side, there's some grandkids. So.
My family's all mixed up. My sister, Eva, she is now Eva Yamamoto.
Okay.
Japanese. Her husband was born in Hawaii.
Okay.
Came to the States through Hawaii early in 20th century. But pretty traditional Japanese family that she married into.
Yeah.
My brother married a African-American gal from Detroit.
Okay.
My wife's Filipino. My brother, he's remarried. His first wife was, she was so white, she was see-through. So when we would get together as five of us, so with siblings and kids and stuff,
right,
we'd inundate into a restaurant or something, and people always thought it was like a work party or something.
No, right.
His family, what was that, the We Are the World?
My father saw that. He would say, oh, look, it's the United Nations,
yeah,
you know, kind of thing. Yeah. That's good, though.
We're all mixed up.
Culture is great when you learn a lot about everybody else's culture. And
what was the Asian culture like growing up in Phoenix, in the Valley, Glendale area?
It's interesting. I mean, a lot of the families actually were farmers. They were either farmers, and then there were a lot of, I don't even know the word for this. They grew flowers. What would that make them?
Florists.
Florists. But like, you know.
Farmers.
They weren't flower farmers.
Yeah.
I think is the official term we're calling it now. Down on the other side of town. I don't know them personally, so if they're listening, I'm sorry.
But all Japanese people know each other. Do you know my sister?
Yeah. You'd be surprised how many people do that, and it's like, oh, do you know so-and-so? And then sometimes it's like, yeah, I do, actually. So, I mean, the town's pretty small. So I noticed over the years, too, like, you know, that generation now, their kids and all that, it's getting a little bit where I may know their father or the grandfather of certain people going, oh, yeah, my dad used to be friends with. At a show recently where somebody walked up to me and said, I think your dad knew my dad. And I'm like, oh, yeah, my dad was best friends with your dad. And on that, they used to hang out. He goes, yeah, because I remember the name of your dad. And so it's kind of interesting here and there. I get stopped after the shows for that. You're Japanese, so you must know. Do you know so and so or whatever, or my wife's Japanese, or I'm half Japanese, or
you know that guy from Happy Days?
Yeah, exactly. Do Pat Morita? Did you know him? Did you spend a lot of time with him? Yeah, I waxed his car. It was great. So that's what I did. So
growing up in the Valley, when was the big boom? As far as population, wasn't there a pretty big one in the 80s in the Phoenix area, or was it before that?
You know, it seems like there's always these booms that happen after major disasters. So, I mean, the 80s, you had a pretty good influx. And then in the 90s, like with what was the Northridge earthquake, there was another influx. And then Florida hit a really bad hurricane. And then actually Prescott ended up getting a huge influx. At that time,
yeah,
because I recall my in-laws used to have a place up in Prescott, and a lot of their neighbors were from Florida that had moved after that last hurricane, saying, we're not doing that again.
Yeah.
So they moved, but there's a lot of Californians I'd met in Prescott, and then some in Scottsdale, too, that had moved after, you know, natural disasters. So apparently we're very safe here.
What's the next one?
What's the next one?
Yeah.
Hang in there, California. Don't fall off.
Yeah, you'll have your
Don't fall off. I don't know how much room we have.
Your Glendale beachfront property.
Exactly. Finally, you'll have something worth something. Yeah. It'd be good.
Now, I first met you a few months back. You came up to Prescott to perform a comedy show up there at the Prescott Valley Event Center. Comedy has always been a fascination of mine. I love it. I grew up listening to, you know, old Bill Cosby albums and Jonathan Winters. I've got a bunch of old Bob Newhart LPs that my dad would listen to. And
nice.
Love comedy. And then I grew up a couple years older than you, but graduating in the early 80s in San Francisco Bay Area, which was a huge comedy boom coming in the 80s there. I love comedy. I love watching guys perform. Were you the funny kid growing up, or?
Maybe I thought I was funny at the time. I don't know. I was a pretty shy kid. So, I mean, I was very, my dad likes to explain the story of me having my finger in his back pocket when we walk around. So I was very shy. It's like I wouldn't hold my dad's hand, but I just put my finger in his back pocket.
You want to make sure he was there.
And I would just follow behind him kind of thing. So I was very shy as a kid growing up. But I would say by the time I hit sixth grade, my buddy Chad was that one kid everybody has, who's that one friend who has the George Carlin album and the Steve Martin album and the stuff you're not supposed to be listening to album. My brother also is another one who's a big influence in terms of exposing me to like the Cheech and Chong albums early on, which got several people we know in trouble. But that's kind of like, that was my introduction. Was like, really, it was a lot of Cheech and Chong, to be honest, around our house, because Chong was like, hey, there's an Asian comic. We didn't know we had those. So that was kind of an eye-opener there. But then I hooked on, actually, San Francisco scene. Steve Martin was huge.
Yeah.
I've got all those albums. And then Robin Williams, when he hit the scene, I mean, I was in fifth grade at that time, and I just latched onto that Reality What a Concept album, which isn't really kid-friendly. That was before the stickers. So that's why I was able to buy that on my own. Listen to that in my room without my parents coming in. But yeah, that was a huge influence. I mean, those guys tend to be more physical on their comedy. And then where Cheech and Chong is more sketch-driven.
Yeah.
So for me, and like in my act, there's elements of all that kind of stuff within it. A lot of physicality and a lot of character kind of thing. So that scene was really took off for me there.
I remember what we used to love watching Sanford and Son on TV as a kid. Right. And we grew up, the area we grew up was really racially mixed. Mm-hmm. And we just loved it. Sanford and Son was hilarious. And you put on, you go to the Goodwill store, the thrift store, and pick up a Red Fox album for 50 cents and put it on expecting Fred Sanford.
Right.
And getting something completely different.
Right.
I didn't even understand what he was saying. I just knew it was hilarious.
I saw Red Fox one time on an HBO special. And I think it was HBO or something. But there's a couple jokes on there that still resonate in my head. Oh. Like, oh, my gosh. It's not what you expect. Buddy Hackett's one that I saw. I remember as a kid, it's like, oh, Love Bug and all these movies. Yeah. And then I saw that. He was on an HBO special, and I was floored. Like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Like, this is completely different. But it's interesting that they could play both sides of that coin, you know, and be loved by everybody at that point.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that while we were eating lunch as far as working blue, working clean. Your act is fairly family friendly. You try and keep it that way?
Yeah, on purpose.
Yeah.
I like to be, I like to get booked. I like to make money doing my comedy. So, yeah, I mean, for me, I'd say I'm... Yeah, I mean, I'm a safe bet. Even when I've got stuff that's like rides the line, but without being, I mean, I don't cuss in my act, but there's things implied in my act.
Yeah.
It's like adult subject matter. It's like when adults talk that you have an adult conversation, literally without having to spell everything out for everybody.
Can't spell things out for me anyway. I got to pull out my phone and start looking stuff up on dictionary.com.
You need visuals. Is that what it is? Okay, where on the doll?
Where were you touched?
No, but I just feel like, you know, being cleaner, I can work a corporate gig. I can work a casino. I'm still funny enough to work a club. I've done churches. I do a lot of churches, actually. I mean, I do improv, too. So, I mean, I can go. We've done improv shows in schools with kids.
Yeah.
To be able to do it all is really great. I mean, you'll get booked and you can that's how you kind of make a living. If you're not, I mean, nobody knows who I am. So it's kind of like, that's how, you know, you work and then people will get to know who you are that way.
There you go. Hacking up another lung. We hear stories that, you know, like the guy, Jay Moore, Chappelle, Eddie Murphy, these guys were hitting clubs. Chris Rock, I think, started when he was like 14, 15.
Right.
Cruising the clubs, the open mics and things.
Right.
You came into comedy a little later in life.
Really
than,
late.
Than the average stand-up.
Yeah. So here's a... Take a break there. So
talk over my hacking.
So when I was a kid... My dad used to say to me all the time, you're funny, you should go to comedy school. Clown school. That's what he used to say.
Was he being sarcastic?
He was being straight up truthful about
it.
Okay. He's like, I put you in clown school. He used to say this all the time. I don't know what he was talking about, but he'd say, they got a clown school up in Prescott. That's what he used to tell me all the time. I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. And so I'm 6, 7, 8, 9 year. I hear this. You should put in clown school, whatever, dad. So as I got older, and you know, I guess I'm, you know, I'm funny to my father and that, but you know, this is like, I grew up in the late 70s and the 80s, you know, I'm in high school in the 80s, and it was the Wall Street boom, and like, I want to make money. Yeah. I watch Family Ties. I want to be Michael Keaton, you know, or Alex P. Keaton. So that was my goal, is I wanted to grow up, go to school, get a job, and start making money. I mean, that was my whole thing.
You didn't want to grow carrots?
I didn't want to grow carrots. That was my brother's thing. Yeah, somebody had to go, you know, take the family torch. Not me. So my brother would tell you I was the laziest person on the field. So, but as I got into college, I was studying, you know, communications and television. And during that time period, I'm doing sketches with my friends for their school projects and stuff. And my dad would still say, still send you that clown school. They still got it up there. So as the years went by, and then I got asked to do a radio show, and I started doing impressions on that show and co-hosting that. And then I started getting these chops, thinking maybe my dad was right the whole time. And right when I started the radio show, my father passed away. And then shortly, a couple years after that, I started doing improv. And then I jumped into doing stand-up. And I kind of feel deep down, my dad knew the whole time that he saw it in me, which I didn't see. Which is kind of funny, because you think, coming from a family that's, you know, Japanese are known for their work ethic, you would think my father would be completely behind.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact is, I did start a business at 20, and I've had my business now for 26 years, you know, so I got that half of it. But the creative side, in a different way, for my own performance creative side, was way later. So I was 38 when I started doing improv.
Wow.
And stand-up, I didn't pull the trigger on that until I was 40, 40, 41. Yeah, so late. Which I think is an advantage for me, is that I missed all those years in my 20s talking about going to the bathroom and, you know, relationships that didn't work out, that kind of thing. Because, I mean, comics in their 20s don't have a whole lot
to grasp onto.
Right, exactly. My college stinks, or my girlfriend left me again, or, you know.
Sex, drugs, and drinking.
I was at an open mic a few years back, and there was a kid who's told a joke about, you can't talk to your girlfriend on the phone when you're going to the bathroom. Because when you try to flush, you can't run out of the room fast enough, because she'll hear it flush. And then she'll say, hey, were you going to the bathroom? Like, no. And the audience laughed. Then he did a joke about missing the toilet, you know, when you stand up to go. And then he did another joke. And then he said, that's all I know. I'm only 21. And I laughed so hard at the honesty of the moment of, like, that's all I know about. So thank you. And then he got off stage. I thought, wow, I've never seen him since. That kid's going to be stellar at 41 when he starts talking about his kids and his wife and, you know, his life experience.
Then it's going to be, I'm only 50. That's all I know. The depression.
Exactly.
The desperation in my voice.
It's going to be the same thing. My wife complains about how I use the toilet.
Wait, now, let's plug your business. What is it that you started when you were 20?
So I got into doing, like, because this was my dream, to do industrial video projects for people.
I mean, it was the glamorous world of,
right, exactly,
of training films.
It's kind of weird, too, because my mentality was a person who was going to go into business, period. So corporate video seemed like a no-brainer. Like, I can do corporate projects for hospitals and companies and commercials and et cetera. You know, I never dreamt of, like, oh, I'm going to be a filmmaker, like every kid on the planet now who has, you know, a phone available. Like, oh, I got an iPhone. Boom, there's a movie, you know. Get a million hits and you're famous. That's the route I went. And I've worked with, mainly I've done a lot of medical-based things. For 26 years, just basically doing training videos. When people ask me, what do you do for a living? I say, if you work for a company and you've ever been forced to watch a video, that's the crap I do. So enjoy. You know, so I'm the guy to blame.
What's appropriate to say in the workplace?
Exactly. Right.
Okay. Well, that brings up a question. When people ask you, you know, when they meet you, hey, Brian, what do you do for a living? Are you a comic, or are you a
now? Filmmaker. Now, I would say in the last year now that response has been changed to I have dual careers.
Yeah.
Because I do split my career now. Pretty much it's 50-50. The video, The nice thing is they never cross over in terms of time-wise. The comedy's always at night. Video's usually always during the day. And I've got set clients that I handle, so I kind of have certain things throughout the year that I kind of know are coming up, so I can kind of schedule amongst the video work and the stand-up comedy. Right now I'm going through a period where I've got a lot of video work, so I will take a month off from comedy, and then, you know, I do have some gigs coming up, but they're light, so here and there. But, yeah, then summer, nobody wants to do video in the summer here in Arizona. Like, oh, let's go outside, really, and melt. Yeah. And then, like, everyone's like, why do we look so haggard in the video? Because we're dying out there, that's why. So try to do more comedy, especially in the summer months. And try to arrange it, too, so that if, you know, if the family can come out and do that, try to make vacations out of certain trips.
Some of your road trips and that.
So.
there you go again. What are some of the farthest road trips you've done for the comedy?
I went to Minnesota this year, which was, it was a great experience, but if you said, when do you want to go to Minnesota? I would not raise my hand and say February.
Yeah.
So we left Phoenix, it was 86. We landed, it was zero. Luckily, everyone we were dealing with was amazing people that had their cars started and the heaters on and would meet you at the door. So we'd be outside 5 seconds, get in the car.
How many gigs did you go do?
Just one.
It was a one-off.
One-off Valentine's Day show at a church in Minnesota. Packed room, great crowd, just had an amazing show. Everybody had a great time. It's interesting, too. Church audiences, they sometimes don't, a lot of people don't go to clubs. They've never been.
Yeah.
They don't know what to experience. If their only experience of comedy is based on, you know, maybe their grandparents' experience, which was, we saw Buddy Hackett or whatever, then they get a little freaked out maybe sometimes. They don't know what to expect. But it's funny, live entertainment anymore is kind of a different thing. I think there's effort that goes into people going, well, let's go see a band live or let's go see a comic. So it's kind of neat that people actually still go out for now.
There's so much content you can get right on your phone, whether it be, you know, like this, a podcast, which used to just be, you know.
We're not even at the same table.
Yeah.
I'm not even at the same restaurant.
He's eating at Angio's. I'm at Jack in the Box over in Willow Creek Road in Preston. But there's so much ways to get content now. You know, going. When I was a kid, if you wanted to see a movie, you had to go to a theater.
Right.
Or, you know, there was the Sunday night movie on NBC or
which
whatever.
Which would be 10 years later.
Yeah.
10 years later, you'd finally get to see Star Wars on TV and go,
The late movies. When VCRs first came out, that was...
Oh.
I mean, I remember when they rolled out. I was in high school, I think it was. High school, junior high. And, you know, a VHS tape to rent.
Yeah.
If you wanted to buy it, just a cruddy... third-rate B-movie was like $70 to buy a VHS movie.
I remember pleading with my mother that I wanted to buy Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee because we'd rented it so much between my brother and I. My mom's like, we could have bought this thing. So we went down to try to buy it, $109. Okay,
sheesh.
And it was on a moratorium, so you couldn't even buy it if you wanted to at the time. So I was like, ugh, you know. So, yeah, those years before it finally priced. I remember when E.T. came out, $24.99, and people went crazy, like, oh, my gosh, I can own E.T.? So.
I took my son to his first theater movie. He's five. This was a year, maybe a little more than a year ago. I don't remember what, Turbo, Little Snail.
Okay.
The snail cartoon movie.
Right.
And 10 minutes into it, he told me to pause. We're at the theater. He wanted me to pause it.
That's hilarious.
So he can go to the bathroom. I said, we can't pause it.
That's funny.
Pop, why can't we pause it? But it was great to see his eyes when we walked in. He had never been in a movie theater before.
Yeah.
To see the biggest TV he had ever seen.
Yeah.
Our TV at home is pretty close to the size of our laptop. And that's where we watch stuff. You know, we stream Netflix or you know, watch stuff on Hulu, whatever, on the phone or on the computer.
Yeah.
Or a DVD. But when he first saw that theater and walked in and the rows of seats, he'd never seen anything like that before.
It's an experience.
Yeah, that's how I used to feel when we would go to the movies, when a big movie would come out. Same thing, comedy. I remember when Comedy Central first got launched, that was amazing because other than that, it was The Tonight Show, Mike Douglas, Merv Griffin.
Right. Dinah Shore, yeah. The big ones.
You would see on a talk show a comic. And other than that, you had to, and you couldn't as a kid, you had to go to a nightclub. Yeah. You had to go see an opening act for a concert or something like that.
Right. And the experience is so different to see it live than it is to watch it recorded. I mean, like, I do improv. Improv on tape is the worst to watch.
Improv gets a bad name.
Yeah. If you see it live, it's a different thing. You'll enjoy it. You'll have a good time. But if you watch, a lot of people don't know this too, but if you watch like Who's Line?
Yeah.
Those shows are edited down. They're like 90-minute shows edited down to like the 22 minutes.
Half hour with commercials.
And you take the best of it, you know? Because, yeah. I mean, improv is, it's hit and miss. I mean, I've done shows where you're surprisingly all night, you're like, that was pretty good from start to finish. But there's always like, that one thing didn't go too well, or that went too long, or you try to tighten it up. But yeah, experiencing it live is way different. I mean, I can't stand watching like improv recorded. To me is not interesting.
Misses
that.
It's not entertaining because you can go on YouTube and search Brian's name. And see some good clips of that's what I did this week. I went through and watched some of your clips. I was blown away at how physical it was when I saw you. The only time I've seen you perform perform live was in Prescott Valley. It was on a stage, and you were animated. You were moving around. There was some physical aspects to it, but nothing compared to what you could see on YouTube with those improv skits that are on there.
I'm an interesting guy in that. I think, personally, I think I'm a much better improviser than I am stand-up. Because that in-the-moment stuff is, I don't know, it's great when it goes well. But with stand-up, I mean, I think I'm an okay stand-up. I mean, I get booked, so, I mean, that's the question. People are, you funny? I don't know, but I keep getting booked. Somebody thinks I'm funny because somebody's hiring me. Somebody wants to give me money. Fine. But, you know, it's different to work in those physicalities for stand-up bit because it's, you know, those are kind of set routines and stuff. And for me to do the crazy monkey stuff that I would do in improv in stand-up might be a little annoying, you know, at times. So it's kind of like finding that fine line because the audiences are different. I mean, they're ready for something different. If you go to an improv show, it's kind of anything goes, and the audience knows that they can shout back, whereas stand-up, you don't want people shouting at you. You try to shut them up and make them laugh, but... yeah, I don't know. It's balancing those two and trying to get, you know, and trying to get the best of.
Now, your first public performance, was that on the radio? Was that when you took that radio gig?
Yeah, radio. I did. I got asked to do a radio show with a buddy of mine here in the Valley, and I was the, you know, I was the co-host, and I didn't really know my role at first because it was all new to me.
Now, well, how did that come about? Why did he pick you? I mean, had you if you hadn't been performing before, or had you already started with the improv stuff at that time?
So again, like my father thought I was funny, and apparently my clients thought I was funny too.
Doing your video production stuff.
So, and you know, here's the problem.
Let me fill up your vodka.
Perfect. So, here's the deal. If you edit with me, we're gonna have a good time. You're gonna laugh. Which is good because I charge by the hour. So we might do 3 hours of work, but you're paying for six because sometimes I get on a roll. Anyway, so my buddy is a producer. So that's kind of what happened is over the years we'd worked on several things together. And he said, hey, you're the first guy I thought of. So he brought me in and the idea was we were doing celebrity news and that kind of stuff. So it was a 3 hour show, which is a marathon.
Yeah.
So we would go through and we would do certain bits here and there. We'd do a news story and kind of bag on the news story. But there were times where I would call in like right after Siegfried and Roy, when Roy had gotten mauled, I called in as the Cowardly Lion, basically apologizing. So Schwarzenegger at that time was running for office. So I was calling in as Schwarzenegger giving political updates as to what was going on. I called in as a drunk Ray Romano once. So that was kind of the shtick was, you know, other than just bantering back and forth, we would do those little bits. And then I started doing other bits off the side where I would do sketches.
Was this all live, pre-recorded, or a little mixture?
Most of it was live. When I started doing the sketches, then I would start doing, I'd have to record because I was doing multiple voices at that point. Then when that show ended, that's when we kind of spun, Stephanie and I spun into our own show, BS Factor, with Brian and Stephanie on All Comedy Radio. And then at that point, I did a lot more sketches based on that show. Similar format, except a little bit more since it was comedy related, we did a lot more entertainment news, but we did the sketches more. But the sketches were bigger. I did a thing. It was the Sesame Street Town Hall, which was when it was Bush. Was it Bush? I can't remember now. I can't remember which debate it was, but it was Bush Kerry, I believe. But that thing, Europeans love that for some reason. I had more downloads in Europe for the Muppet stuff. Did a Muppets Take Titanic thing, all this kind of stuff. That stuff took off. The National Lampoon picked up on some of those.
Oh, nice.
At one point, they started airing them. All comedy would air them. So that kind of got me out and about doing that. But I enjoyed doing the sketch stuff a lot. But, you know, it gets lonely. You're the only one doing all the voices after a while. Actually, I'm working on an album now of sketches because I like, again, I mean, Cheech and Chong is what I was influenced with. So I kind of want to, I don't know, that's my forte that kind of got me into doing comedy in the first place. So I do have, I think I've got 10 or 11 sketches done right now.
So oh, nice. I'm
trying to get a few
have
more
done.
Have
you already started recording them or in the structure stage?
That all came about because I already had some good sketches that a lot of people still haven't heard. So I thought, well, I'll put together an album of sketch because I thought about doing a stand-up album. But then again, I'm so physical. A lot of my punchlines are physical or me in a situation. And I was listening back to some recorded stuff one time going, nobody can see what the punchline is. You know, me dancing around is one thing on stage, but on, you know, it's dead air to the next person just with an audience laughing. They're like, well, what's he doing? I remember years listening to like Steve Martin albums going, I wonder what he's doing right now that they're laughing at. So I had like 3 or 4 bits in a row off my stand-up that I thought, you can't put out a stand-up album. No one's going to, you know, use your imagination, people. You know,
include a picture book, a little pop-up book.
That would be unique. Boop. And then you turn the page. Boop. And then it'd be just like grade school where you're the page off. And it doesn't make any sense.
So
I like that idea.
Now I was going to say scratch and stuff, but never mind. Now, at this point, had you already started doing the improv classes and things, or did it kind of branch off of radio?
Yeah, when the radio show kind of abruptly came to an end because the studio or the station was being sold, and so there was all this politicking going on in the back room. So
big business at work.
That ended, and I was looking at some info for a film festival coming up, and I saw an audition for an improv troupe. And so, and again, performing live in front of people was not... Radio is one thing where you're talking and you're like, I'm assuming someone's laughing somewhere. Yeah. I'm just going to assume somebody
is. No immediate feedback.
Yeah.
And no audience.
All right. Unless you have somebody in the room who's going to laugh, that's your only feedback. So so I thought I was killing it in radio because my co-host was always laughing. Good laugher. Actually, we call her Farkas after the Christmas story, Farkas, because her laugh is very... So... No, but I signed up for the improv thing, and I auditioned, nervous as all get out, and I had a friend of mine who used to do improv years ago and said, just commit to your character, you'll be fine. So I went in there and just committed to what I was doing, went through the audition, they liked me, they brought me in, and the theater was supposed to launch within 3 months. It probably took 6 months to finally launch, but during that time, it was, you know, we were getting good instruction and learned the craft, and can't say I really thought I was any good until probably that into the first year where I thought, okay, I get it now.
Yeah.
There's so much to learn. And like, even now there's so much more to learn. And I watch you watch good improvisers and you're like, that guy's great. That's a great thing. And I want to learn how to do what that guy's doing. So, but that was my launch pad into live performance. Cause I believe it's easier to bomb as a troop.
As a group. Yeah.
To spread the blame. So the stand up, it's you.
How much of a success to a bit in improv can be related to it actually going sideways and bombing. I mean, think of some of the old Carson bits when, when it wouldn't go well for Johnny Carson. That was often the most memorable, the funniest aspects of when he would do his skits. Sometimes I've seen that with improv where things will go a little sideways and not as planned, and that's what really stands out is how you recover and things.
There's, it's twofold. I'll tell you, when I was, the original troupe I was in is a scenario where you have open auditions and you get all kinds of people from different backgrounds, and that's really great at first. But after a while, when you're into it, year two, you know, some people get better, some people don't, and then you're kind of restricted. Whereas when you're doing scenes, if you have that person who doesn't advance the scenes, and you're kind of like stuck in this rut, like, give me something to work with. Luckily, you have, in a large troupe like that, you'll have one person off stage who'll like come in with something genius, save it, and then the audience even has that relief of like, oh, we didn't think anything was going to happen there. That's one way in which that gets resolved and can be great, because it's that awkwardness and like, yay, it's been saved.
Kind of danger almost. Yeah.
The troupe I'm with now, with the guys that kind of, they were in the other troupe too, but we formed our own four-man troupe. We know each other so well and we're so tight that we don't have those types of problems, but we do get in the situation where something happens, it's just way too funny, and you get giddy and you lose it on stage, and we try not to like break the character, but sometimes you just do. We lost one night, the place we're performing had swivel stools. We normally have just wood stools, but they had swivel stools, and they were parachuting, so they were laying down. Well, they didn't know they swiveled. So as they were swiveling, belly down on the stool. So as they started to swivel, the way they were spaced out, for whatever reason, the guy in the middle couldn't swivel because the other two were moving too much. But he kept getting kicked in the head repeatedly. So it was one of those things where we're off to the side, kind of, you know, basically narrating kind of what was going on. Man, we lost it. It was, the audience was all on board. Everybody's laughing. Yeah. And it just keeps going, and it kind of writes itself. But everybody experiences that moment. It's really cool.
And that's a four-man troupe that you're with now?
That's a four-man
improv. Who is it? Who do we got in there?
It's me, Mike James, Kevin Schneider, and then Brandon Brooks.
And what do you guys perform under? What's the name?
We've gone through several names at this point. We were Improvenauts, which was a name I voted in. You should see the laundry list of names. Those are pretty funny. Now we have a separate thing that Mike and I started called Cross-Eyed Comedy, which is geared toward doing churches. We found that the majority of the improv shows we were doing were for churches and fundraisers, mainly. So we just basically have taken it under the Cross-Eyed Comedy heading at this point, which we do stand up under Cross-Eyed Comedy also, but this way we just branded it under that for now. So I think it's going to stay probably Cross-Eyed Comedy Improv at that point. So, because we're doing less improv now, but it kind of comes in pockets. Somebody sees us, they're like, hey, can you do this? The shows we have coming up later next month is based on another show somebody saw us do for another charity.
Gotcha.
So, you know, we've done some things for orphanages, and people think I'm lying when we're helping an orphanage. But there still are orphanages, people. Don't forget to donate. So.
Now, how do people find out about that aspect, the troop wise? We got your website, BrianKotze.com. Mm-hmm. Is there a website or a web home for the troop, or is it linked through yours?
CrossEyedComedy.com.
Okay.
I think there may be a link off my website to that, too. Usually,
I'll search it.
They're
put
all
them on. Put them on ours, too.
Yeah.
Now, what about the solo stand-up? When did you... What was your first solo gig like? What, your first time doing stand-up, what were the circumstances around that?
So, because I don't like to do things normally. So when I was doing the radio show, a friend of mine, Chris Mason, who was doing the show, it's on Fridays, he was a comic, he said, I'm going to do a show, why don't you come host it? And I said, I don't know what I'm doing. He goes, I'll kind of teach you how to host just to keep the show going, but you can do some jokes if you want. Just do a quick 5 minutes or whatever you want.
Do a little intro and then intro each comic as they come up.
So I said, okay. So now what I don't realize is that when we do the radio show, I'm funny only because Stephanie would read the story and set me up, and then all I had to do was punchline zingers.
Yeah.
And then ha-ha, and then we move on. So I get up there on stage trying to do basically the setup, but I don't know how to edit it down, so I'm just rambling, and then by the time I get to the punchline, nobody cares. And it was like, it seemed really long up on stage. I was like, I'm dying, I'm eating it bad. And for some reason, I thought I could really sell this Dancing with the Stars joke, which I wasn't a performer. So the minute I started the joke, it's like you have two brains. You have the brain that's actually speaking, and the brain in the back that's telling you, you suck.
That internal monologue.
You shouldn't have started this joke. And I remember starting that joke with the back of my brain going, you're an idiot. You have to finish this joke now. Let's see how this goes. And it was so bad and so painful. Then I never wanted to do stand-up again after that. And then right around that time is when I started doing improv. So there was a lull about three years before I did stand-up again. And that was all because Mike James, who was also in the improv troupe, Mike James said, let's try stand-up. I said, I tried it. I don't want to do it. He said, come on. So he put a group of people together, like 20 people.
Yeah, he wasn't doing stand-up
at that
point.
He wasn't doing stand-up either. And so we decided to get together. We had a friend of ours who owned an acting studio. He said, I'm going to have these people meet, and we're going to get together. We're going to write. We're just going to do stand-up. And I said, I'm not really interested. And I actually was on a family vacation for the first week. So the second week, he goes, just come. I said, all right. So I watched, and people were getting up on stage just trying to do jokes. He gave everybody 5 minutes. At that point, there's probably 11 people in the room. I'm just sitting in the back watching. And this old guy decides he's going to try it. So he gets up on stage. He rolls on stage, and he mutters, live from New York, it's Saturday night. That was Chevy Chase. I was like, oh, my gosh. I looked over at this person next to me. I said, give me a piece of paper. So I jotted down a 5 notes. And I said, okay, I'll try it. So I went up and I just did a quick 5 on miscellaneous. And I did pretty well. And I'm like, all right, I'll try it again. So, and that was kind of the whole genesis of that restarting. So we did a little showcase and it went really well. And then got a couple bookings and then just kind of went from there. And the rest is somewhat history. History to this point.
Yeah. What do you got coming up? We're sitting here on a Friday. You've got a strong weekend this weekend at the Comedy Spot.
Right.
Which is kind of a home for you?
I would say that's my home club. Yeah. So I'm there.
This will post Monday morning. What do you got coming up? Anything on the horizon? You just got back from New Mexico.
Right. I did my little stint in New Mexico and the casinos there and made some new friends. I know who all the Japanese and half Japanese people are in New Mexico. Just kind of did. I actually coming off doing a lot of comedy right now. Then I've got a bunch of video work that I just did. So yeah. I've got a month of editing ahead of me. So I've got for April. I've got 17th. I have an improv show for this recovery ministry in Mesa, and then the following night, the 18th. Mike James and I are doing a show at the Comedy Spot. We're co-headlining that show. It's booked as Mike James and Friends. He tells me I'm co-headlining. However you want to look at it.
You're Friends.
And Friends, right. It's that whole Gilligan's Island and the rest.
And the
That's
rest.
Me. So that'll be 18. That'll be 2 shows at the Comedy Spot, 7 and 9 o'clock on that Saturday night. And then there's a romantic novel convention happening in Glendale, and I'll be doing somebody saw me and said, like, hey, will you come do 30 minutes at our thing? So,
like, at the convention for the delegates,
right? And so apparently, I have to have long blonde hair and a sweltering chest.
You're Fabio telling
jokes, exactly. Good evening, ladies. Here are my jokes.
How's the comedy scene in Phoenix in the valley here? It's having said that, it's a lot larger than I thought it was.
How much time do we have? No. It's pretty big. It's constantly growing. I think during the economic downturn, a lot of jobs were lost and a lot of comedic jobs were created. which would hold true for me too. I had just started comedy and kind of that saved me a little bit. There's a lot of up and coming. Like, if you talk to the older comics, the ones that have been around 20 years, they'll tell you, I've never seen this many comics at one time coming out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
The Phoenix scene's pretty interesting. It's pretty spread out. I won't talk a whole lot about it because there's a lot of... There can be drama in the scene.
Yeah.
But there's... You know, everybody's style's different and everybody's going to do their own thing. And it's just, you know, get out there, do your thing, be funny, and, you know, keep working it. That's the thing. But, yeah, the scene's pretty big here.
What I've seen just by looking through, like, the online listings and the club listings and things, there's a lot of open mics. There's a lot of urban rooms, you'd call them. There's some improv going through, and then there's the main clubs where you can catch the touring national headliners. So there's a real good mix. There's a couple of bars that are popping up doing comedy nights for, you know, either no cover or really low cover. And like I said, there's a lot of folks out there performing. Some names you may recognize, some you won't. A lot of guys doing dual jobs and doing comedy on the side and things. I was just surprised it was thriving that much. I didn't realize there was that much out there.
It's interesting that, like, you know, in the last year we've had Laugh Factory just opened, and then House of Comedy opened, coming up on a year here in August, I think. You know, obviously Tempe Improv's been here forever, and Stand Up Live. You know, and then all, you know, Comedy Spot. There's plenty of clubs, but like, I think it's just because there's been, I mean, we've got a booming population here, so it's not surprising that, you know, there'd be more the clubs coming here. I was actually pretty shocked when I saw that Laugh Factory was actually coming, which is great. I mean, it just means there's a demand for it. Yeah. I think there is a demand. People are always looking for things to do, especially in the summer months here. It's too hot. You know, go indoors. My theory is use somebody else's air conditioning for a change instead of your own. So, you know, that's always tell people, come to the comedy club. At least it'd be cold. So it's always cold in the comedy clubs. They keep it ice cold for you. You laugh.
Keep you alert.
That's exactly it. They do purposely keep it cold for those reasons. But like House of Comedy, I perform there. It's a little bit different club in that it's Rick Bronson who owns it, is a comedian out of Canada. And they do it a little bit different. The host does, you know, 20 minutes. They bring up the middle act, who does about 15. Then they bring the host back up for another 10. Mm. And then the headliner comes out. So first time I did that club, it was, took me, you know, a couple shows to get used to it.
It's kind of a different rhythm.
Yeah, you divvy up your set. You have to have like two completely different sets. And, you know, you got to close strong both times. So you got to have two separate closers and figure that pattern out. But that audience is, to be honest, is really different. So this is how I compare, like, the Comedy Spots in Old Town Scottsdale. People like going to Scottsdale because people like to pretend they have a lot of money. So you go to Scottsdale, you take your friends, you have a good time, and you spend a lot of money. But you're there for a good time, and you laugh hearty. Whereas House of Comedy it's a great club. It looks fantastic. The clientele up there those are real Scottsdale executives who live up in that area. So they don't belly laugh like the rest of us. They laugh, they nod their head. It's very little audible laugh, but they're engaged. They're just not loud. So when you're performing, it's a little off-putting at first. Yeah. Like, am I connecting at all? So
definitely not a bar gig.
But I was there with Rob Little. Rob Little's this national touring comic who's hilarious. I've known Rob for years. Rob's up there doing his thing, and he's experiencing the same thing that all of us were. We're like, are they just not into it? So he finishes up, and I'm hosting that night, and he's like, thank you very much. Standing ovation. And he looks over at me like, what? And
what
I'm
happened?
Like,
where
you
were
got
they?
Me. Exactly. Yeah. This is the same audience. So the weekend shows, standing ovation, all shows. And both scratching our heads, and everybody's walking out going, you guys are amazing. You guys are fantastic. And it's like, well, where were you when we were in the room? You know, we're sweating it, but you're like, apparently you're thoroughly enjoying it.
Yeah.
But it's just a different, it's just figuring it out, knowing that, and you got to adapt to every audience. And
I'm guessing at that location, you're probably not getting a whole lot of crowd work. You're probably not getting a lot of heckling.
It's funny that you say that, because there was one table that was a little bit rowdy, and we always talk about the fact that school teachers and nurses
worse
tend to get a little mouthy. I don't know what that's about. School teachers get drunk. They're just, you know, like, we had your kids all day kind of thing. I don't know what it is.
It's our turn to be the obnoxious.
But they're not too bad. You know, the bachelorette parties are the ones who are like, well,
traditionally.
Yeah. So, but yeah, it's interesting. Like up there, yeah, there was just a couple of teachers, but they were respectfully playful, you know. Yeah. That's fine. I mean, nobody really matters. They don't care too much if people are like that. And it's not often. I mean, I've never experienced, you know, crazy heckler ever.
What's the worst you've had to deal with?
The worst I've had to deal with, and this is ridiculous. So I do the joke about drawing on your eyebrows. So I do the joke. I'm at the Tempe Improv, and everyone's laughing. After the joke was over, I moved on to the next joke, and this woman just yells out, "That's not funny." And I was like, "What?" And I said, "You must draw your eyebrows on." And then everyone laughed, and she's like, "Well, it's still not funny." And then I said, "Everyone's looking at your eyebrows now." And like everybody in the audience was trying to look over. But that's the worst.
And you couldn't get the spotlight on her.
But it's an odd joke to be like, "Hey." Yeah, and the joke's not derogative. It's one of those things where, like, women do
it's
it.
It's a funny bit.
Women
it's
do
that's
it.
That's on YouTube. That eyebrow bit is on there. It's hilarious.
And then one other time I had somebody yell out something during that joke. And it's like, what is it with women and the eyebrow thing?
You hit a nerve, man.
And again, it's not like, you know, most women are laughing. I mean, now I go out of my way to point out a lady who's laughing really hard. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? And she's like, yeah, she'll nod her head, she'll laugh. You know, so it's like, but that's rare. I mean, in 5 years, two times, you know, every once in a while. You know, recently I had, in Flagstaff, unrelated, the guy was drunk for other reasons, not paying attention to the show, yelled out something in the middle of my set. Again, it was non-related. He was a Native American guy who yelled out, "Yes, because of the white man," it was the eyebrow joke. That's right. That was the other eyebrow joke. I just remembered that was it. I said something about, you know, the ladies wax them off and then draw them back on. Yeah, because of the white man. I'm like, yes. I mean, I don't know how you answer that. The audience was laughing too. Like, what was that about?
Scalping connection in there somewhere.
I guess. I don't know. And it was like, okay, moving on. I mean, that's just funny. Weird. So, yeah. I don't know. I tell comics all the time, just be funny. And hopefully they'll just be laughing. They're not going to heckle you, you know. But you get the drunk guys every once in a while. You know, it's fine. Just talk louder on the mic. I mean, you've got to control the room. Just control the room kind of thing.
So. How are the clubs down here as far as controlling that? Are they pretty good? We were talking earlier, some of the clubs and bars I used to go see comedy at years and years ago. Every bar and restaurant where I was growing up started putting a comedy night, and they knew nothing about how to set up sound. They didn't care. Just, right. Oh, we're going to sell more drinks. No lighting. They'll, you know, take the lampshade off of that lamp in the corner. That's your spotlight.
Exactly.
And they had absolutely no idea how to control a room.
Right.
You know, in the middle of a basketball game, TV gets TV's turned on. Off, jukebox is killed. Oh, yeah, and that comedy in the corner now.
Right.
And they were just horrible. People would be throwing things. And for us, as stupid drunks in the audience, that was funnier than the comics, just to watch that.
Yeah.
Are they pretty good about the rooms, maintaining them here?
Yeah, the rooms have to be set up accordingly if it's not a comedy club. And the comedy clubs are always going to be, you know, you got an audience that's there to see comedy that's going to go in expecting, I paid X amount of dollars, I'm going to see comedy, period. Whereas some of the bar shows, you know, you get people kind of wondering, what's going on in here? How much? Okay. And sometimes the shows are free and they'll sit down. And but the comedy clubs, for the most part, I mean, yeah, everybody's there for the same purpose.
They're coming to see comedy.
So they're prepared. I mean, they're geared up. They're ready to laugh. Yeah, and then, I mean, there's always some type of security there that's, you know, ready. And typically, you know, most people just, you know, they don't realize how loud they're talking. So sometimes it just takes a shh. Oh, sorry. And they're back in it, you know. Unless they start getting a little tipsy or whatever, and then, you know, if they just happen to be annoyed. It's funny, too. I mean, if it's something like an eyebrow thing sets them off, something else is going on in their life that they probably need to, you know, be gone. But most of the time, I mean, it's pretty good. I've seen very few times have I seen a situation where, like, this is one story I witnessed years ago, which is just amazing. So I was doing the radio show. Jim Gaffigan came in that day. He was going to be at the Tempe Improv. He came in. We had a nice 30-minute interview with him. And super nice guy. He left. Go to the show that night. And he was getting ready for, this is prior to that that first pale face.
Mm-hmm.
Before he recorded it for Comedy Central, he was making the rounds. So Gaffigan's up on stage. He's probably up for 20 minutes at the Tempe Improv. There's a guy wearing a cowboy hat sitting in the front row. And the whole show, you kind of see his head swiveling back and forth. I mean, the cowboy hat makes it really obvious.
Yeah.
But he keeps talking to his woman back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And Gaffigan, at one point, just, you know, he does that double voice thing. You know, like, you know, I'm Korean. He doesn't look Korean, you know. So he's doing his bit. He's up there. So 20 minutes go by. Gaffigan just stops. He's like, hey, buddy, what gives, man? But like furious. And he's like, do we have a problem? You've been talking to her all night long. You're not paying attention. You're just being a distraction. Knock it off. And the guy's just kind of looking at him. They're having some conversation. Couldn't really hear what the other guy was saying. And then Gaffigan's like, we could take it outside right now, and I'll make you shut up. And then he drops the F-bomb on the guy. And then the whole audience is like, whoa. Now it's getting a little bit serious. At this point, I'm thinking, where is security, right? Nobody came up. And then Gaffigan goes, yeah, that's right. Indiana boy's got a little a kick at him, right? So then the guy kind of shuts up. But it's like, it probably was 40 seconds, but felt like 4 minutes. Everyone's like tense, yeah, sitting there watching. And so we're waiting. No security. Gaffigan's just staring at him. Finally, Gaffigan looks at him and says, are we good? And the guy kind of nods. And he goes, all right. And then Gaffigan stops, looks at the audience and says, that was weird. I mean, the place blew up, exploded. We were laughing so hard. I'm like, that is the best. Like, going right back, like nothing happened. Yeah. And like, only that character for that moment fit. It was just like, that is the funniest thing. He handled it. He did it. And he got back on track and finished the set. And it was like, God, it was just great to witness. After the show was done, I walked up and, you know, I just saw him that morning. He goes, were you in there? I said, yeah. He goes, what was that about? You know, it's like, that's just the coolest thing. I said, just when you went back into it, I'm like, God, you're such a professional. My gosh. I don't know if the average comic could really have taken that type of scenario. Like, you just threatened to take the guy outside and then you go back into this feminine. That was weird. You know, it's like, wow.
Yeah, that could go so far south so fast to completely, especially in a spot where the rest of the club can't hear. They're only hearing your interaction from the mic. Then it's, why is he picking on that guy in the, you know?
Yeah.
That could get ugly.
But that was just like, man. And Gaffigan, of all people, you know.
Because it's so out of character for him. He's so... His persona on stage is so mild.
Like when he dropped the F-bomb, you're like, okay, it's serious now, which is another thing. It's like being a clean comic. When you do that, people perk up like, oh, what happened? Kind of thing. And it did. For that purpose, it just, you know. But man, brilliant. Great. One of the greatest moments, I think, watching a true professional work.
Yeah.
I mean, that guy's something else.
You mentioned Cheech and Chong as being early influences and guys that got your eye, Steve Martin.
Yeah.
Who now do you see out there that are that are leading the pack as far as stand up?
In my opinion, my favorite guy to watch right now is Jim Brewer. I don't know what it is about. I mean, he's physically amazing. The voices are there. I mean, for obvious reasons. I mean, I watch him. Not to emulate or imitate or anything else, but just to like, this guy figured out his talent and how to use it completely. Yeah. And he's gone completely family friendly now. He's clean all the way through. He did a show in Wickenburg last year, and I just caught wind of it. I said, Jim Brewer's coming to Wickenburg?
That's kind of like off the beaten path.
So I looked up tickets and all that kind of stuff, and I saw that it was family friendly. Kids' tickets were only $5. Oh, wow. And also, you could do childcare if you didn't want to put your kids in. But my kids had watched the Jim Gaffigan or the Jim Brewer special with me at home several times. It became a mainstay in our house where we would watch that. So, and again, my kids are—I don't know if we covered that. We covered that in our personal conversation.
Yeah.
12 and 9, you know. So, I got tickets for the kids and the wife, and so we went out to Wickenburg, and that's the Del Webb Center out there, which is part of the high school there.
Yeah.
Really nice center. So we go in there, and the opening act was a guy that I'd opened for, Rich Aronovich, here earlier in the year. And I saw him, I got talking, and he goes, hey, and I told him, I said, my kids are here. And he's like, that's really cool that your kids are like fans of Jim's and all that. He's like, I'll get you backstage afterwards.
Oh,
so
cool.
So the show finishes, and then Rich came out and got me. He says, come on back. And man, Jim Brewer was so cool. He's like, he looks at my kids, he's like, you guys, I've got to be like the youngest kids I've ever seen. Like, my daughter was 8 at the time. My son was, what, 11? He's like, you guys are so cool that you're like fans. He goes, I can't believe. He's like, you're going to be the youngest fans who come and see the show. He's like, what are your favorite bits? And my kids are telling him. And they're like, he's like, oh, man, I almost did that one. And I almost did that one.
They didn't get dragged there. They were there.
He goes, I wish I would have known. I would have done the bit for you. And then apparently Richard told Jim that I was a comic. And he goes, hey, I hear your dad's a comic. I bet your dad's the funniest guy in the world, huh? And my kids are like nodding yes. And I said, my kids are lying right now. They're lying so much. I said they really enjoy watching your stuff. And, you know, they quote it all the time. He's like, it's just so cool, man. And then he told me, he goes like, man, just keep at it, man. You know, I mean, he's never seen my set.
Yeah.
That'd be one guy I'd love to, like, you know, open for at least
get
at some
show
point.
Notes yeah. from or something. Have you seen the documentary that he did?
Oh, his dad?
With his dad.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
It's fantastic.
I'm a fan of his. I liked his, yeah. I liked his, you know, his bits on SNL and, you know, his physical humor and says it's funny. And he's just a funny guy.
Yeah.
But after watching that documentary, I had a whole new appreciation for him.
It is
just amazing. It floored me. It taking care of his dad who had was it Alzheimer's or... I don't remember what it was.
It's not Alzheimer's.
Exactly. He needed full-time care,
full-time
so he took him on the road with him.
Yeah, I don't know how much was... Yeah, I can't remember exactly what's going on. He had his health issues going
but
on.
But it blew me away. I had a whole new appreciation for him after watching that.
That's... So my father passed away, 12 years ago? I remember watching that, and it got toward the end of it, you know, when he was talking about... When they asked him, like, what are you going to do when your dad passes? And just the fact that he couldn't answer it, was like... It's the hardest question when you're close, because I was really close to my father.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, obviously, watching that documentary, Jim Brewer's super close with his father. But it's weird, too. I mean, when you got somebody in, like, Jim Brewer's type of profession to just say, you know what, forget it. I'm going to take my dad on the road with me. I'm going to spend as much time with him and just have some fun. And, you know, and documented it, too, in a way that wasn't, like, self-serving.
Yeah.
It was almost like, let's preserve these great moments with dad.
Yeah.
You know, putting them on stage,
yeah.
You know, just to watch the show. It's the coolest thing, man. It made me like feel like I wish my father had gotten a chance to see me perform. That would have been cool to have him sitting there. You know, I would have done the same thing. Spend time with dad, go on the road. Who wouldn't want? I mean, granted, everybody's relationship with their father is a little bit different. But, you know, if you have that kind of relationship, I mean, man, that's cool. But, yeah, that documentary is fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't remember the name of it, but... If you're listening, Google it. You'll find it.
I saw it on Netflix. It was there. Yeah, it was good. You had mentioned with your early spots in comedy, improv, and on the radio and that, doing a lot of impressions.
Right.
What was the first impression that you knew you were good at it?
When I was a little kid, I used to do Jimmy Carter, which we're giving away our ages. I remember that being...
No, I remember him from history class.
Exactly.
I already said I was older than you. I forgot.
You've eaten his peanuts and his peanut butter. So that's the first one I remember. And then, of course, you know, as a kid, it was just all the Muppets kind of started coming about. And then as time goes on, like, there's impressions I do that, like, haven't served no purpose in society anymore at all. Like, in high school... I mean, I can still do Pee Wee Herman really well, but there's no reason to do Pee Wee Herman at all. You know,
I think he's got a new movie coming.
He's got a new movie coming out. So
you got a whole another 15 minutes.
So we'll see what happens. Well, I do this thing called celebrity diagnosis in my routine, which is like, what do you do with old celebrities? It was kind of an excuse to do some, which is them giving you a bad health diagnosis. So there's some room I've been playing with, possibly bringing a few back in that. But yeah, like, I do a pretty good Dennis Miller, which is kind of like, the dialogue is really tough on the Miller stuff. Cause you know, you got to get the cadence going and then you got to keep going fast. Usually then there's F bombs dropped in the middle of it somewhere, but it's, you know what I mean?
Miller, anytime I heard him, I would, this is, you know, before smartphones, I'd have to hurry up and open up an encyclopedia or a dictionary just so I can keep up.
I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to do the Miller bit, I think, on the album, because the gist of the bit is if Dennis Miller were your father. So it's basically right after getting a report card and just berating the kid with, it's so dialogue driven.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that's really hard to memorize. I've never done it on
the spot.
Yeah, I've never done it on stage.
Watching Brian sweat here at the restaurant.
It's really difficult because it's just like, you know, your mother and I. It just goes on and on and on and on. But it's bam, 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 bam.
What was the toughest impression that you did to dial into?
It's funny. It's the one that everybody does, and I hate doing. Everyone does walking, and for some reason, it always ends up sounding like Travolta coming out of my mouth. So... I try to stay away from it. I'm trying to think. I don't know. There's I've been asked from some people, can you do whatever? And sometimes the impressions get so overly done by people that it really doesn't sound like it. But, like, you know, you get used to, like, Dana Carvey's version of something or so-and-so, you know, like Will Ferrell's version of George W. kind of thing, where you just accept that as the norm. But if you listen to them, they're not close.
Are you doing, is somebody doing an impersonation of the person or an impersonation of the impressionist?
Right, exactly. I used to do on the radio show, I got known for this thing called Burt Reynolds Celebrity Crank Calls, which would just be, this is when Punk'd was out, it was a big thing. So we did our version, which was Celebrity Crank Calls. So Burt would call somebody and then hang up and laugh on them. So it'd be like, is this Ryan Seacrest? Yes, it is. Click. So that was the whole thing. So that's what got me national recognition.
That's funny.
That's ridiculous. I remember calling All Comedy Radio. I said, hey, I was in your contest. The Celebrity Burt Reynolds Celebrity Crank Calls. Oh, yeah, we love that. I'm like, okay. You know, it is what it is. Nobody knows who Burt Reynolds is anymore. So hang in there, Burt.
He's the old guy from Boogie Nights.
He's the old guy from Boogie Nights, exactly.
I think they're getting ready to kick us out of here. Run through again where folks can reach out to you, your website.
BrianKahatsu.com. You can find me. Everything's there. My Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, what else? LinkedIn. Not that we really need you to link in with me, but if you want to.
Google Maps your house.
Google Map my house.
Show up.
I'll do the Miller thing for you there, if you care.
And then next time you're in Phoenix,
come on out to Anzio's for sure.
Anzio's, A-N-Z-I-O-S, anzios.com. I'll put a link up on the Facebook. Anything else you want to hit before we wrap up?
I think we covered a lot. We covered a lot today. You guys missed out on the main conversation.
It was fun.
About our kids and all our good.
I'll stick this out. Anytime you got something to plug or a show coming up, hit me up. We'll come on down and sit down and do a little blurb. I'd love to.
You know what I will say? I'll just say this real quick. That two things. One, Matt Santos is an incredible photographer. You know, I move around a lot on stage, and I called you and I told you, you're the first photographer in 10 years to get me without a blurry arm or blurry face going. So thank you. Kudos to you. Secondly, I know you press kit for the most part. I mean, you got press kit's comedy scene's booming.
Yeah.
They're on top of it. I mean,
any plans
they're doing
coming
a great
up
job. I don't have anything scheduled, but I mean, I keep getting invites from everybody, so I'd like to get up and at least see everybody's. Get up there and perform. But yeah, I mean, that site and Prescott's been really good to me. I mean, everybody reaches out and has brought me up and keeps calling me. And so, but I love the town. Everybody's.
I hear they got a good clown school up there.
They have a great clown school. For all I know, maybe I was born in Prescott.
So. I think we're good.
You okay?
Wait. Who's our waitress?
Grace.
Grace, we were just telling people to come on down to Anzio's. How long have you been here?
See Grace.
November. So, December,
January,
February.
2014?
And, and you can trust Grace to when you don't know what to order, just tell her, order for me. And she brought me a great
she'll
personal
bring you anything
pizza.
Anything off the menu.
You can't go wrong.
That's right. You can't.
Pizza.
At all. That's right.
All right. So, I think we're good.
So go Prescott. Go Matt Santos.
Anytime you got something to plug, give me a holler.
Awesome.
And I'm up and down the highway a lot out here. I have no idea. I'm looking at the levels here. I know you are coming in strong. Okay. I don't know if it's going to be a one-way conversation, I think. I don't even think my mic's picking anything up. So this will probably be the highest listened to episode because people can't hear me. My wife is so happy I lost my voice.
It'd be a cough every few.
And a slurp.
This episode is brought to you by Ricola.
By Ricola
and water.
And Lederhosen.
It's water. We live in a desert. Remember to drink.
All right. Thanks, Brian. We'll put links up to the sites and I'll go through your schedule and post that. I'm always looking for stuff to post up there. I like piggybacking on other people's success.
When I get there, come see me.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks.
Well, that was it. That was my talk with Brian Kahatsu for episode 16 of The Mile High Show. We are available at milehighshow.com. Please check us out for current and past episodes. Again, a big thank you to Brian for bearing with me as I squeaked and squawked through that interview. We We actually had sat down for a lot longer than the time that you heard on tape. We had a great conversation. It was fun getting to know him a little better. And I anticipate sitting down with him again in the future for further conversation for his upcoming shows and to promote what he has going on with his improv troupe and everything else that he wants to talk about. He's got a good story. And again, I think about halfway through there, he was getting a little worried. I was maybe giving him throat cancer during our conversation. So I appreciate him bearing with us. And also the good folks at Anzio's and at the Comedy Spot. The Comedy Spot is a great venue for stand-up comedy. It's a very small, intimate club right there in Old Town Scottsdale. And I encourage you to check them out. We'll have links to their upcoming shows. The staff there was outstanding. The comedy by Bay Area favorite Mark Pitta was also great, and the other comics that were there. So check them out. Check out Brian, and please continue to check out the Mile High Show at milehighshow.com. And hopefully, this will be the last episode where you have to hear me squeaking and squawking on the microphone. Hopefully, the voice will be back soon. So let's get out of here. And again, thank you very much for tuning in.